Before the Great Alaska Earthquake of 1964, it was just an unproven theory that the continents swim around on the molten mantle of the Earth. Then a hunk of the undersea Earth ripped from Prince William Sound to off Kodiak. Not just a theory anymore. Good morning and welcome to Talk of Alaska. I'm Steve Heimel. A slow process becomes high drama suddenly, and we learn. Our phone number statewide, toll-free 1-800-478-8255. A local call in Anchorage of 550-8422. Email talk@alaskapublic.org. The state of the art in earthquake awareness, the subject today on Talk of Alaska statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by
First National Bank Alaska, earning Alaska's trust for more than 90 years. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC. May is National Bike Safety Month. Alaskans are riding their bikes to school, work, and play. Motorists, be on the lookout for bikes and pedestrians. Bicyclists, follow the rules of the road. All riders should wear a fitted helmet and use reflectors and safety lights to be seen no matter what time of day. Go to injuryprevention.alaska.gov for safety tips. This message sponsored by the Alaska Highway Safety Office and the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
Well, I like a scientific conference, but I'll have to admit that I was not real excited about the Seismological Society of America, even though it was the national convention taking place right here in Anchorage, Alaska. But I went, and I was blown away at all the things that I was able to learn, even though I totally came into it not speaking the language. And you talk about, you want to know some people that have a language of their own, talk to seismologists. It's just, you have to learn a whole new vocabulary to discuss this stuff. And we're going to explore that a bit with the state seismologist, who actually is pretty good at interpreting things for the general public. Michael West, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Thanks, Steve.
So I've built you up now, and now you have to be your communication skills. But I did see you do a really good paper at the convention with regards to the Columbia Glacier, and I thought maybe you could reprise that a little bit for our listeners, because it says quite a lot about the state of the art.
It does. That's definitely one of the things that's on our radar screen in 2014. You know, for several decades now, we have tracked earthquake activity across the state. That's our responsibility at the Alaska Earthquake Center, our mandate from the state. And in the daily slew of earthquakes, the small earthquakes that we record in and out every day, there have always been a small subset that came from areas that are heavily glaciated in the state. And they've received a fair amount of attention in the last several months, in the last couple of years, and we're finally beginning to understand some of what they mean. And for the first time, we actually have a really nice, clear record of what has happened at some glaciers in the state from detectors that were put in place to track earthquakes. So kind of a surprise. It's not what we were really after.
Glacier quakes?
That's right. That's the term that's used.
Well, what do? Do they rattle around inside, or what? Look, glaciers are, it would seem like they're always shuffling and so forth.
You know, it actually...
They got crevasses that open and close?
They do. So there's all sorts of different ways that glaciers make noise. You're right. There are crevasses that open, and things are shifting and moving around all the time. But the big source is one that everybody knows. If you've ever been on one of those tourist cruises where you go up to the glacier and watch the big iceberg calve off the front, that's a tremendously loud noise, right?
Yeah.
And those icebergs falling into the water make a signal that is recordable, vibrations that can be recorded 200-300 kilometers away sometimes, equivalent to, a magnitude 1.5 or 2 earthquake.
So, essentially, the equipment that your industry, your business, seismology business has become so sensitive that it can hear the splashes of these glacier calvings.
Well, I like the spin you put on it. I guess I would think about it this way. Our sensors are really quite dumb. They're not made to listen for earthquakes. They're made to listen or record anything that vibrates the ground. It might be trucks going by. It might be, bears in the area. It might be wind. It might be glaciers. And, yes, it's often earthquakes, too.
Wow. And so the way that your paper went was that you said, okay, so we've seen this noise for years from the glaciers, and we just basically been trying to eliminate it. But I saw something happen so strange with the Columbia Glacier, I figured I needed to look into it.
Yeah, for years we paid attention to these events because honestly they were a bit of a nuisance for us because we don't want to be reporting on dozens and dozens of earthquakes near the terminus of a glacier in Prince William Sound when actually right. there aren't earthquakes. So we've identified them for a long time to help filter them out. But you point out Columbia, one of the more interesting records. It's an example of the kind of thing that you can do by looking at a glacier over the course of several years. And Columbia Glacier was not making this kind of large splashing sound very much up until about August of 2010. And in August of 2010, that changed dramatically. And now it's banging away, you know, every day, especially now in the spring, as the glaciers wake up, our analysts are spending a lot of time locating these events from glaciers.
All right, so why is it doing it?
Well, as we started to talk around with our glaciologist friends, I mean, full disclosure, I'm not a glaciologist.
You're not even a geologist.
No, that's right. All I do is seismology, I guess. But as we started to talk around, it became clear that a lot of things happened right around 2010 at Columbia, and the terminus of the glacier, in fact, changed its position in a really significant way, and it went to being what's called grounded. Instead of being a piece of ice floating out over the water, kind of like an ice shelf or something, it had retreated to where it was essentially on land. Yes, it was still ending in water, but the base was actually sitting on the ground. And we've been able to put that together, and we're recognizing a number of places now that when that happens, we start to see it, record it in a very different way.
And very simply because we all know that 90% of the iceberg is under the water. So here's this glacier, and a whole lot of it is in deep in the water. But when it fetches up on a shelf of some sort, then when it calves, they're going to fall.
That's exactly
it's
right.
It's going to be a bigger fall. Very simple, really.
That's right.
You just had to think about it here. Well, I was impressed with that.
Excellent.
But the fact of the matter is, that's just one little tiny dimension of what is going on in the seismology field in Alaska, where we're being, well, basically, they're instrumenting the hell out of Alaska. They're putting instruments at incredible density now all across the state. Even as we speak, people are out there in the field drilling holes and installing seismometers all across the state. Amazing.
Well, there's a lot of stuff to track in this state.
Well, what is going to... So it's going to be essentially a grid. A grid going all the way to the offshore, even. A grid going all the way into Yukon territory of sensing and, like, spaced...
Well, you're referring to a particular project, a particular
yes.
initiative... that's moving forward right now. Let's back it up just a little.
All right.
Since you led with your intro on 1964, it is a fascinating year, 2014, to be looking at the topic of earthquakes and earthquake monitoring in Alaska, because with the anniversary of the 1964 earthquake just recently passing us, it's a time to reflect over the last 50 years. And what's stunning is that in 1964, when that earthquake happened, there were two seismic monitoring stations, two earthquake stations in Alaska, one in Fairbanks, one in Sitka, not even close to the earthquake, right? There had just begun to be a global monitoring effort toward earthquakes, really just in the 2 years prior to 1964. This was kind of the birth of modern sort of earthquake studies. And in 50 years, we've come a tremendously long way in the state. We now have a pretty good handle on day-to-day activity. We're able to track the earthquakes that happen. And there are a number of different efforts that have sensors all around the state, focused in South Central and Interior right now. But then, as you point out, there is an initiative underway right now that is changing that landscape, at least on the scale of a few years, and will provide a much different level of coverage, especially in parts of the state where we've never had it.
So these seismometers, the National Science Foundation pays to get these seismometers put in, and then they come back and take them away unless somebody finds some money to keep them running.
Well, you got to understand, this is a at heart a research project, an academic endeavor. It goes under the name of EarthScope, by the way. That's the project that's unfolded over the last decade in the lower 48. And the entire lower 48, all 48 states, were instrumented on a dense grid about sensor about every 70 kilometers, 50, 45 miles or so, and occupied for 2 years. And it provided information about earthquakes in the lower 48 and the structure of the earth that were really not imagined prior to that project. So now we're excited. This project is beginning to roll into Alaska. It'll unfold here. There's a big effort this summer and then the next few summers to bring it all into place. And they will be in place. This network will record for a few years.
So how does it work with your center? Because you already have your own, and I assume that some of yours will be part of this array.
Right. So the Alaska Earthquake Center operates a network of sensors with the specific mission, mandate from the state legislature to report on earthquake activity in Alaska.
Which is very good. Yeah. I mean, there's a website, and it's got the quakes on it.
Yeah, you wake up in the morning and you hear on one of your programs or something, a magnitude 5.5 earthquake last night, whatever. That's information that ultimately comes through the center from this network.
So how do they know where it happened? How do they triangulate it?
You know, I could spin it as a really complicated process. Uh-huh. You can bet there's a lot of different algorithms involved and whatnot, but at its root, it really is it's a fancy form of triangulation.
Uh-huh.
That's absolutely right. If a sensor is really close, it records the earthquake right away. If it's far away, it takes a lot longer to get there. And it's, that's the math behind it.
We're talking with Michael West, the state seismologist, live here in the studio on Talk of Alaska. And our telephone number is 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK. Earthquake awareness. State of the art is what we're trying to get to here. And believe me, an hour is not going to be enough because there is just so much. All right, let's take Noatak because it was in the news. As a matter of fact, the first I heard about the quake at Noatak was Lori Townsend got a new app. It tells her about, and she says, well, I was looking at it, and it says Noatak. I never saw one in Noatak before. Is this true? So we went to your site. Yes. Yes, it did happen. It did happen. And they felt it. We called up Nome. They said, we didn't feel it, but we called up there, and they did. It was pretty substantial. And then there were more. And so then the next thing I hear, you've actually managed to get, did you do this yourself? Or somebody went out there and got some instruments out there?
Well, that's our mandate. So
yeah.
The Noatak sequence has been pretty interesting. It's not without precedent entirely. There was a comparable earthquake in July of 1981, I believe, but it's been quite some time. On April 18th, the first earthquake occurred, magnitude 5.6, and it had a very vigorous aftershock sequence, not unexpected, but a lot of felt earthquakes over the next several days. And then that sequence began to taper out, as aftershock sequences do. 2 weeks later, it was followed by essentially an earthquake of the same magnitude in the same place, which doesn't happen every day. You start to refer to that maybe as an earthquake sequence as opposed to an aftershock. It's all semantics.
So now we're waiting for another one?
No. Well, that's the sticky part of this business, right? There is always that sliver of chance that another earthquake could occur of comparable size or larger. But there's no reason, we have no reason to believe that that's the future right now. Just to be sure.
We all love to corner you guys.
I know. Earthquake prediction, right? That's what, if only. But we are very interested in understanding why those earthquakes happen and what the potential is for, you know, for larger earthquakes in a general sense. Is that region capable of having large earthquakes, or is 5.6 about as big as it can get?
And to find out if there were some in the remote past is not as easy as people might think, because it takes a geomorphologist. Somebody has to go out there and look for the evidence that it had happened at some time in the past, because nobody had instruments on it back then.
That's right. Big earthquakes that actually rupture the surface, leave traces of what they did. And there are people who are highly skilled at, you know, interpreting the signs to figure that out.
Thank heavens.
No, now we are, in the present right now, our focus certainly is on the instrumented record that allows us to see other things.
So basically it's, wish anyone an earthquake, but if there are more quakes there, you'll get more data, right? Because you'll be able to get with the instrument so close, you'll be able to get more of a focus on how deep and what the shape underneath might be, whether something's sliding around there or exactly what is going on with the faults, right?
Well, that's right. The sequence in NOAATAC has had many, many hundreds of earthquakes, small aftershocks, and most people don't feel the majority of those. However, each one of them tells us something about that region. For example, if we can track the whole cloud of earthquakes, if you will, they begin to map out faults and begin to illustrate, you know, the depths of where this kind of activity is. So we got a lot of questions when we instrumented the area right after the earthquake. In full disclosure, our monitoring is not terribly dense. It's not particularly good, frankly, in western and northern Alaska, because we don't have a lot of instrumentation there. Historically, the focus has been, and the funding has been focused on south central and the interior. So after the second earthquake, we did, a couple people from our organization went up and did install a couple of new sites. I have to say, the citizens of Kotzebue and NOAATAC were incredibly helpful. It's not easy to roll in on very, very short notice and try to, you know, install instrumentation and have it beaming data out live and all that. It sounds easy, but it's actually quite an impressive engineering feat at times. And they really came out. There were tons of people helping out, and really just more volunteers than could even be put to use, as I understand.
Well, as you may not be a geologist, but you must be aware that there's a there are a number of mineral resources in that hunk of geography there.
Oh yes,
and there is interest, for instance, in the coal. There's at least one really substantial prospect beyond Red Dog that I know of, and I'm sure there's others. Especially when you get over towards Ambler, you know, that's the one that they're all worked up about now. And so people are very geology aware, I would say, up there right now. And so in that light, you know, I'm wondering, can anyone say if there can be an effect from the simple weight effect of removing all that ore or moving it around, you know, because it's a massive zinc mine up there?
There's no evidence that the mining activities in that area, you singled out Red Dog, for example, there's no relationship between that activity and the earthquakes. The earthquakes are natural. They are something that happens. We have decades of records of earthquakes occurring in that area, and there just isn't a tie. Though it isn't entirely inconceivable that changing mass on the surface of the earth, whether through a dam, a reservoir, or mining, you know, can in theory impact.
I understand
the activity.
Gotcha. Telephone number 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK. Mike West is with us. He is the state seismologist, and we're going through the state of the art in earthquake awareness. And it's pretty fascinating because this array is being installed all across the state of Alaska. It's going to tell us a lot about the geology of the territory we live in. And for geologists, and you're a seismologist, for a geologist, this is like going to be a gold mine, you know, to be able to define where how these plates are moving around. Essentially, is going to be, you know, that's what makes not just earthquakes, but also volcanoes.
It's all related. That's right.
And then there's, like, for instance, you have instruments now, because the funding's available, at the Susitna-Wautana Dam site, right? Same deal.
That's
trying
right.
to figure out what is the structure underneath there. Got to know.
Well, structure's part of it, and to me, that's a very progressive example of trying to get ahead of the earthquake problem and make sure that should we ever decide to go ahead and do that project as a state, that we've got we've got a baseline. We understand what that area is capable of, what it isn't, and we'd know how to identify any changes that happened because of a reservoir.
Yeah, the Seismological Society of America put out the publication, the research letters for this conference, quite fat. Is it always this fat?
it's a little weightier than it's sometimes.
Close to an inch thick here. And in it is a marvelous article, of which you are the lead author, Why the 1964 Great Alaska Earthquake Matters 50 Years Later. And as you explained to me, well, the last time the society met in Alaska was 25 years after, so why shouldn't it meet 50 years?
That's right.
That makes all kinds of sense to me. But at the end of the article, you go into this fascinating business about earthquake early warning. The idea that because of the immensity of the geography involved, South Central Alaska is actually an excellent place to try and put in an early warning system. We might be able to get better, earlier notice than a number of other locations, like in California, where they're already working on one.
You know, there's a lot of history for this around the world. There are several countries, many different areas, that have implemented what's referred to as earthquake early warning, which is not really the ability to, let's move away from earthquake prediction, but
right.
say, well,
that's what you think about it. You know, the guy in the lab coat with the Tesla coils and everything, and the hair
shooting
out.
Oh, we do dress
out.
That way. We still dress that way.
Oh, okay. Well, glad to hear that. and he's got some hocus pocus that's going to actually tell you that an earthquake is going to come. You know, a month from now. No, an hour from now. Not quite, but...
No, this is more on the scale of a minute.
Ah.
You know, once
you could do a lot in a minute, though.
Well,
could get underneath something substantial in a minute, for sure.
You know, when an earthquake happens, it takes time for the waves, the vibrations, to ripple out, not unlike throwing a rock into a pond. And, if you want to extend that analogy, you could think of, throwing a rock in the pond and counting the amount of time until the waves actually got back to the shore where you are. So in earthquake early warning, this is an endeavor focused on trying to pinpoint very quickly the moment of that earthquake so that you have the time between then and when the waves actually reach you to be prepared. And, you know, a lot of people joke and say, well, really, what am I going to do with, 20 seconds or maybe a minute? But we live in an increasingly automated world where, yes, it probably might provide you time to go into a different room or go to a particular place in the building. But the way our systems are all interconnected now, we think more in terms of, being able to shut off valves with, gas pipelines, or being able to slow traffic. Imagine something very, very simple, like changing all of the streetlights to red, just stopping traffic. That alone, there are all sorts of these things that are tied together through elaborate computer systems, and that's all something that we could feed earthquake early warning into. I have to tell you, this is not an endeavor underway right now in Alaska. But I do believe strongly that South Central is well positioned in many ways for this type of system.
And so, you have the electronic signal, right? In other words, if I had a sensor at a certain point, right, and it was very close to where the earthquake was centered, it could say, well, the there was just a tremor, and it could send me that information way ahead of when the wave traveled. But the wave travels way faster than the speed of sound. And then what? There's a primary wave, then there's a secondary wave, and then there's when you sense the primary wave, you know when the secondary wave is coming, right? Have I got a thumbnail of it now?
You do. An earthquake sends out different kinds of ripples, if you will, different kinds of waves through the earth. And fortunately for us, the ones that travel the fastest, we refer to them as P waves, or primary waves, the ones that travel the fastest are among the least damaging. So these are small vibrations that travel quickly, on the order of 4 or 5 miles per hour, or miles per second, forgive me.
Yeah, really.
4 or 5 miles per second. But it's your
kilometer conversion.
I'm trying my best to work in statute miles here. But the slower traveling waves, S waves or surface waves, things that travel maybe 2 or 3 miles per second are the waves that do the most damage. So this is why we can exploit.
So it's like twice as fast.
Yeah, more or less. That's right. Uh-huh. So that means those arrive when you first the first waves that you arrive. And many people in Alaska certainly have experienced this. A little jolt. We typically feel them in the middle of the night. We're kind of most sensitive laying in bed, but we'll feel a little jolt, and then a few seconds later, a little bigger shaking. That's exactly this difference, these two different sets of waves that you're feeling.
Wow. So. Okay, now, then there's other waves. Then there's even slower waves that come later. I mean, I'm still lying in my bed remembering that last earthquake, which happened early in the morning. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking, I've been through enough of them now that I sort of know that there's a pattern. The first you get that thing you're talking about, oh, I think there's an earthquake happening. And then it starts, and then it might build quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, is that building, is that the secondary wave, or are we starting to get to yet some other wave after that?
Well, it's hard to tell. It's very hard to judge an earthquake by what you feel in the first second or two, because quite often, the vast majority of the time, you're feeling a modest tremor. You have that little jolt, and then a few seconds later, something a little bit larger, and it goes away. But the initiation of a larger earthquake actually might start out with a very similar kind of vibration. If you, one of the last truly damaging, massive earthquakes on the earth was in Japan a couple of years ago. Everyone knows about certainly the Fukushima fallout and whatnot. But during that earthquake, people who were at some distance from the epicenter, it was a minute or more before the strongest shaking actually came in. So the first things that they felt were, in fact, relatively modest tremors that grew and grew and kept growing and kept getting bigger as these later arriving waves rolled in. And you have to remember, for a large earthquake, it might take several minutes just for the earthquake to happen. The little tremors we feel, month in and month out, are earthquakes that happen. They're over and done in a second or two, the actual fracture in the earth. But for massive earthquakes, you go back to, 1964 or something, this is an earthquake that took 4 or 5 minutes just to occur in the earth, let alone the shaking that happened. But the actual breaking of rock took that long. So that's a very different scenario.
Yeah. So from all the way up in, like I said in the introduction, all the way up in Prince William Sound, all the way down to off of Kodiak.
That's right.
That all ripped.
Many hundreds of kilometers.
It all ripped.
Not that unlike a zipper. It started in beneath Prince William Sound and moved over the course of 3 or 4 minutes down to the Kodiak region.
Yeah. Our telephone number, 1-800-478-8255. Mike West is keeping us on the edge of our seats here as we discuss seismology, of all things, the arcane field of seismology. I mean, I just think, it really does blow my mind that we're so close to being able to actually handle these things. I mean, not, you know, not like we can stop an earthquake, but being able to respond in advance. I mean, just amazing. And that it's already happening in California, that they already automatically use the early warning system to send a signal, Bay Area Rapid Transit, and all the trains slow down. I guess what happened so far is the early warnings are not necessarily that good on the magnitude. So we got in Japan, the magnitude of the first reports were actually quite small and rather a routine quake. It wasn't until a bit later that they, you know, when I say later, I mean in terms of seconds, really.
Well, this was that problem I was hinting at a minute ago. Even for people feeling an earthquake, it's challenging to know whether those first few jolts are the beginning of something much larger or whether they're the tail end of something small. At an instrumental level, you know, at the level of, you know, sensors, that's a challenging endeavor as well. But there are ways around it, and that's where the technology, that's where the focus is these days from a research perspective.
All these algorithms, and there you are in a catbird seat as a state seismologist. Michael West, our guest, as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from
Providence Imaging Center, with its newest center in Soldotna, offering CT scans, MRI, ultrasound, and digital X-ray to residents on the Kenai Peninsula. Learn more at provimaging.com.
And by
ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating jobs and business opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
Feel free to jump in the conversation, but if you don't, I can keep it going, and we got some emails coming in. 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK. A local call in Anchorage at 550-8422. Email talk@alaskapublic.org. Mike West, the Alaska State Seismologist and the guy that runs the Alaska Earthquake Center, is with us in the studio, and we're talking earthquakes. 50 years since the Great Alaska Earthquake, and what is a gap? They talk about the Shumagin Gap. What is that? Is this a place where it seems like there should have been an earthquake, but there hasn't been one?
In a word, that's pretty good. That's a pretty good summary.
Whoa, so we got gaps. We got gaps.
Think about it like this. I'm going to go back to my zipper analogy, a somewhat tortured analogy, but I'll stick with it. The fault that runs along the Aleutian Arc all the way up into mainland Alaska, a few thousand kilometers long, we'll use that as an example, doesn't rupture all in one big piece. You know, it ruptures several hundred kilometers or, you know, smaller at a time. And so if we go back to kind of our zipper, this would be a bit like opening up, you know, one part of your zipper and then a different part on your jacket, right? And there's still a little piece that's maybe you got some teeth that are still clinging together in one place. You might refer to that as a gap. And the way these faults tend to operate is to you know, open up pieces at a time, and that often means that there's one piece that looks like it hasn't gone for a while, for example. There's a lot of mysteries, a lot of things that aren't understood about it, because we're understanding now that some of these faults can actually rupture very slowly in slow earthquakes, if you will, that may not shake and rattle us the way typical earthquakes do that we're used to.
So, you know, I seem to recall in your paper, you're talking about the basic, before the 64 earthquake, Now, we have one plate, and we actually know that it's running, what about, let's stay with centimeters, running like about, what, 8 or 9 centimeters a year, right?
The Pacific, we're talking yeah. tectonic plates yeah. here. So the, you know, the Pacific plate and continental North America, or Alaska, are in fact, yes, converging at a rate of several centimeters per year.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so that energy has to go someplace. I mean, that is a movement that's going to be taking place, and that's where earthquakes are going to come from if the pressure builds up some way.
Yeah,
right?
They don't slide nicely past one yeah. another. There's a lot of friction. Yeah. And, you know, people kind of smirk, like, what's a couple centimeters, really, when you're talking about, you know, things the scale of continents. But 5 centimeters in a year is 50 centimeters in a decade. Give it a century, now you're up to 5 meters. You're talking very, very significant, a lot of strain that's built up.
So were you around when the Denali Fault last popped?
I was not. You're referring to the November 2002
yeah.
Earthquake,
you know,
magnitude
day.
7.9. Oh, yes.
Yeah.
A defining moment in Alaska seismology.
Well, it was indeed, because it, you know, it was quite a big one, and it was a big hunk once again. And the worst damage was really in the more remote area, kind of over towards the east, as I understand it. And but I mean, the photographs were pretty impressive.
Oh, it was more than 300 kilometers of fault. It was a big, I mean, that was a massive earthquake, 7.9. That was one of the largest strike slip, kind of side by side sliding earthquakes in, you know, on a continent ever recorded. We're tremendously fortunate that it happened in across a swath of the state that isn't as densely populated as some places. That's really the only reason that we would escape significant, or, you know, tremendously significant damage. It's in fact, I think there's a danger in that. And we as Alaskans, we see earthquakes like that and think, oh, magnitude 7.9. Yeah, we had one of those and it didn't hurt anybody. We've got a certain magnitude scale in our heads that's off. We have this magnitude 9.2 earthquake in 1964 in our history. It's another benchmark. We say anything else is kind of relegated to being a smaller earthquake. I have heard people, researchers, probably myself included, say things like, "Oh, it was only magnitude 8," referring to, you know, some other earthquake, which is completely warped. A magnitude 7 or 8 earthquake is a massive, massive event, and in Alaska, more often than not, we're not going to intersect with people. But it's that, you know, that it's not the first 9 earthquakes, it's that 10th one when we actually intersect with population where I think we've got risk.
Well, Mike already wants to put you on the spot, Mike. This is a question from another Mike. It says, well, you mentioned minings and dams, and, you know, here is this Wautana Dam, second tallest in North America, within miles of 2 fault lines, one the Denali Fault, 40 miles away. Well, how well do we know what might happen to the Denali Fault in the future? Do we at all?
You know, the Denali Fault is one of the better studied faults in the state. We're fortunate in that it leaves a very clear surface record. I mean, anyone who looks at a topographic map of Alaska, you can look down and say, there's the Denali Fault. It's a striking feature on the surface of the earth. Because of that, and because it goes through a geologically rich area with a lot of things that would cut across it, there's a decent record of its historical activity. So people do have a pretty good understanding of the Denali Fault. The 2002 earthquake was not a surprise. No one knew it would happen at that point in time, but it was well understood that that earthquake should be expected someday.
And we can expect more, I would think.
We absolutely can. And so that's why it's really important, as we take a look at development projects and whatnot, to make sure that we're engineering accordingly. The many people know the pipeline story from 2002, a spectacular engineering success. That didn't happen by accident. That happened because good people spent a lot of time trying to understand that system and making sure that we engineered for the anticipated earthquakes. And that's exactly what's going on in the Susitna, you know, Watana, you know, project right now.
You've got a plan for it.
That's right. And trying to make sure that you really understand exactly what earthquake scenarios are possible.
Let's go to Roger, joins the program from Anchorage. Welcome to Talk of Alaska with Mike West. Roger.
Hey, howdy. I appreciate you taking my call. I'm one of these amateur guys, amateur in a lot of things, but I'm very observant. I've been going out to the beach on Kinnick Arm behind Elmendorf since 1968, and I've noticed a lot of changes and stuff. And one thing that's happened out there is the bluff is bluffed off. It's revealed a vault that's opened up to the surface. Air bubbles out of the ground for about where I walk, about 3 miles aground, along as the tide comes in up over it. Not in a straight line, but there's pockets of air. I've taken a Pepsi bottle with the bottom cut off from it and put it over there, and I've blown that balloon up so it almost popped.
Wow.
I've had the Division of Oil and Gas out there, and they wanted me to get samples, but I have to have a Mylar a balloon. That way any gases, you know, like the methanes and your helium and stuff won't percolate out to the surface. And I've been having trouble finding somebody to go out there with me to do that, because I don't want to do it myself and stand over those air vents.
I don't blame you.
And there's also, I got pictures of two vertical faults that run off the bluff. One of them happened in 2002 in that November quake. It's about a 50-foot bluff, all sand, got different color strata lines in it, and that shifted 11 inches from one side to the other and never fell.
So let me ask, you're talking about sands and sediments and old muds that are fractured?
Yes.
Okay, so... I don't know if I would use the word fault to refer to those, and I don't know the particular feature that you're talking about.
It sounds fascinating. Fracture for sure, though.
Yeah, yeah, and you did say it's on a bluff, so it makes me think that you may well be talking about something, shifting soils, basically. Often what we see on the surface of the Earth is not so much the fault rupture planes of earthquakes, but the way they intersect and the way they shift soils above them. So, I don't know the specifics, but it sounds fascinating.
There are probably people in the field would be interested in your observations.
I would think so.
At the USGS, perhaps, right around the corner over here.
I've sent them some before on this the venting of air and stuff, and I've taken pictures out and stuff, and they just kind of shrug their shoulders. So I'm not going to force them to do anything.
Well, I don't blame you, Roger. Thanks for bringing it up.
And there's another one of these slippage things I found that's very much older, and I took it down and showed it to Joe Kurtek. I don't know if you know who he is or not.
No. Mm-mm.
He's the state geologist for BLM out of Campbelltrack.
Okay.
And I showed him both these pictures, and I showed him this ancient slippage thing that I had. I took him a picture out yesterday, and he wants to go out there and look at it with me.
Okay, well, good.
So I try to keep people interested, and I like to watch things that's going on around me so I know what I'm doing.
You know, I like that. There's so much of... what we see around here is geology that's happening in real time. You know, it's one thing to talk about stuff that happened 100 million years ago, but I think it's really fascinating when you can see it, you know, over the course of years, and observations like yours are the way to do it.
Right. So anyway, I appreciate it. But if you're interested, I'll give you my email address, and you send me yours, and I'll send you these pictures of these two
right. Yeah, please do that to talk@alaskapublic.org.
Talk@alaskapublic.org.
At alaskapublic.org. That's it.
And I'll send them that address.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'll pass them on.
Thanks.
Thank you, and I appreciate you taking my call, and things like you're talking about is of very much interest to a lot of people, even though they don't call in.
Ah, well, they're calling now. Thanks a lot. Thanks a lot, Roger. It's might as well do the break now as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from this APRN member station.
The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports and provide services to the flying public. Passengers are influential in making flying safer in Alaska. When passengers know their rights and responsibilities, aviation is safer for everyone. Safety information online at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
So, Mike West, you drive out to Turnagain Arm and you see these ghost forests out there from the 64 earthquake because the land dropped, the salt water came in, killed all the trees. So we get a question from Jay in Kodiak. He says, look, if it went down that much, is there a possibility it might come bouncing back someday?
Oh, that's a great question. And it's likely not to come bouncing back quickly, but what it is doing is coming back very, very gradually, slowly.
It is coming back.
This is the buildup of stress, the buildup of strain between earthquakes that is happening. And certain areas of the state now are slowly storing up this energy for, you know, the next earthquake of that sort, which isn't, you know, a repeat of 1964 isn't expected for several hundred years based on prior history. But, you know, it'll take over the between now and then, this energy will get stored up, and you can absolutely expect those areas to be elevated again. And so the next earthquake of that nature is likely to cause those areas to subside again.
I guess we should say also, the more that we can dope out the actual structure that's going on under the surface, the better off we are in terms of knowing about what's going on down there.
Certainly.
Where that tension's building up and so forth like that.
Well, there's a tremendous amount of history to be pulled from the sediments and the soils. 1964 was one of the places where geologists really first appreciated that you could go back and get a history of, you know, prior occurrences of that earthquake, and you could kind of pull out the earthquake cycle, as it's called, from that record. And it's exactly places like the writer's asking about that.
I guess, you know,
made that possible.
David Montgomery came up here. Some salmon people brought him up here, this geomorphologist, and he was talking about how at one time, even during the last glacial maximum, there was this colossal lake in interior Alaska that ended up becoming the rivers that with the drainage as we know now. And he was speculating that that's actually why the Pacific salmon are speciated the way they are. But to hear him talk, he can bring something millions and millions of years ago alive in your imagination. Amazing. Great writer, too, of course. Let's go to George. Joins the program from Anchorage. Welcome to Talk of Alaska with Mike West. George.
Hey there. This is, I wanted to say, first of all, this has been a fascinating program, and Mike, I think you're a very good interpreter of science for the people who are listening in. Really appreciate that.
Well, thank you.
And I would say that what you've just been talking about actually leads up to the question I have, and that is earthquake maps and, you know, danger zones. You know, the Anchorage Bowl has these earthquake maps that tell you which areas they think are going to be worse off in an earthquake and which ones are going to be more stable. Mm-hmm. And how do they figure those out? Because not everything moved during the 64 earthquake that is in a red zone. And do they go around and poke holes in the ground to figure out what you know, what the substructure of the soils is, or how do they do that?
No, that's a great point.
And we could do a whole show with that.
Yeah, but I think there's two things to keep in mind. One, 1964 is, you know, a nice benchmark. It showed us some things that can happen in an earthquake, but there are countless scenarios for other, you know, equally damaging or more so earthquakes that aren't that earthquake. So there's a small danger in treating 1964 as an example of everything that can happen. So there is an effort underway right now to revise the seismic hazard maps, that's the term we use, to for Alaska. And this is that's one piece of this puzzle. Let me summarize it this way. There are a lot of different things that come together to get at your question. One is, what are the likely earthquakes in the area? You know, so there's a lot of different faults, each with different kinds of magnitudes that might happen, and we need to take into account all of those in some way. The second key feature is the soils, the place where you actually are concerned about. Is it on bedrock? Is it on sandy soils? Is it on muds? And yes, that is something that people address by doing on-site testing. And so you got these two different things, the likely earthquakes and then the response of the area where you are, the site effects, we call it. And together, those help you get at your overall risk of seismic damage.
Okay. Well, thanks a lot.
Yeah,
for
George,
sure.
I had a question for Mike earlier when I was thinking about doing this show, because I discovered that there's these holes that are bored into the ground in the Delaney Park Strip, and there's a network of seismic sensors in the Atwood building. The silver building used to be the Hunt building. And so I was asking, you know, because I looked at the layers that they'd found and saw there's all this Turnagain clay underneath there. And I thought, geez, maybe all that could go. You know, maybe they need to revise this map, and they haven't done it yet. But he was quick to tell me, no, it has to be kind of close to the bluff before it's really likely to go in a quake.
I forget the exact conversation.
Yeah.
But certainly the soil type matters tremendously.
Yeah.
You do point out this this network that operates in Anchorage, I think is worth people knowing about. It's a set of instrumentation that records. It's used not so much to figure out where earthquakes happen, but how the municipality actually responds, how the soils in different parts of town respond. This is the so-called strong motion seismic network, and it's a tremendous asset for the state and for the municipality. It's the really about the densest instrumentation of that type in the country, and it's not every day that as Alaskans we get to be, you know, the leaders in something like this. But it's an asset that I think everyone should be aware of, and a lot of good research making use of that data right now.
So, George, thanks for your call.
Well, thank you. It's interesting because I would just assume that if it moved in 64, then we know where the hazard zones are. But it sounds like they didn't even poke holes in the ground so much as they just put sensors out, and they figure out when there are smaller earthquakes, that tells you which areas are most likely to move.
You know, George, I'm concerned about a lot of earthquakes that don't look anything like 1964. A scenario that I think a lot of Alaskans should become familiar with is the earthquakes in Christchurch, New Zealand, a couple of years ago. We're talking about a magnitude 6.1 earthquake. It's very small by Alaska standards, if you will, but very real shaking, that killed 150-some people in a first-world country. And it happened, because the earthquake was right under town. It was very shallow, and Christchurch was built on soft, wet sediments. And much of Alaska is built on soft, wet sediments. If you're in the coastal areas, right, if you're along the coast, we tend to build down in the bottoms of, you know, spectacular fjords. These are areas that are sediment rich. We get tremendous rainfall along the coast. If you're in the interior, you've got permafrost and very saturated soils. A lot of Alaska is built on wet, on wet soils. I was in Barrow yesterday. You know, everything is on stilts, right? Why is it on stilts? Well, because the soil's not really reliable and strong with permafrost issues. So this is, I think, a very real concern for Alaskans. And the Christchurch, New Zealand example is one to keep in mind.
George, thanks again. Thanks so much for your call. Wow, I'm suddenly feeling real secure with my piece of peat along Fish Creek and Spinard. It's all dried out peat. It's not going anywhere. Just okay, Diane in Anchorage, you're on Talk of Alaska with Mike West.
Hi. I think you just answered part of my question, but I have been searching for several months for a real map of the actual faults in the Anchorage or South Central area, not just of the soils and the probability with different colors, but an actual fault map. And I've even talked extensively with a librarian up in Fairbanks at the DGS department there, and I cannot find any. But I get the impression that even if I were to find a fault map, so I don't build a house on a fault, that you have to compare this also with the soils, as you mentioned. But can you tell me if there is such a fault map?
Sure. There's a great fault map. You're talking to the right people. The Department of Geological and Geophysical Surveys released a new map just a year or two ago. There's a nice online interface, actually, to it. I'm pretty sure it's accessible through the division's homepage at DNR. Certainly anyone there, the person who you're talking to, could put you in touch with it. But it's a good overall sort of statewide view of not just faults, but which ones are active. That word fault means a lot of things to different people. And the Earth is filled with faults, but not necessarily all of them are active right now. In fact, most aren't. And even the ones that are active, what does it mean? Does that mean they move very slowly and every once in a while have a significant earthquake? Are they highly active? So there's a lot of nuance in the discussion of faults and what to be aware of. And you're absolutely right that faults are, understanding a fault is not the end of the story. But I would venture so far as to say that the site effects, the soils on which you're built, are probably more important than the faults themselves.
Diane, that's all the time we got. Thanks. Thanks for your call, Diane. Well, Michael West, it was really a pleasure, and I hope we'll come back sometime. We can do more of it, because the calls are flooding in now.
Excellent. Excellent.
Mark,
thank you.
I'm sorry we couldn't get to yours. And Tom and Talkeetna. Next week on Talk of Alaska, we're going to be talking about heat pumps up in the Seward area. Thanks to Josh Edge, Dave Waldron, and Tristan Sammons. I'm Steve Hyman.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by
Providence Imaging Center, offering 3D mammography since January 2014, technology that helps their radiologists detect breast cancer. Learn more at provimaging.com. May is National Bike Safety Month. Alaskans are riding their bikes to school, work, and play. Motorists, be on the lookout for bikes and pedestrians. Bicyclists, follow the rules of the road. All riders should wear a fitted helmet and use reflectors and safety lights to be seen no matter what time of day. Go to injuryprevention.alaska.gov for safety tips. This message sponsored by the Alaska Highway Safety Office and the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services. This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.